9:37, 23 before 10, talking about crime in New Orleans and the whole thing that happened in Lakeview earlier this week. Peter Scharf, our guest, adjunct professor at LSU Health New Orleans School of Public Health, our friend, frequent guest. Hey, Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Tommy. This is a wild series of events.
Let me talk about Micah Scott. And he was one of the two suspects arrested. A third one remains at large, but I sense that the other two are going to roll on him, and the police are just waiting to pick him up. But Micah Scott, okay, this story just astounds me, because he was arrested on a charge of armed robbery, which he pled down, and for that he received probation. Then he was caught breaking his probation by carrying a weapon, and he went back to jail, I presume juvenile jail. But then he was out on the street to get involved with this mess on, I guess I should say allegedly, earlier in the week in Lakeview. But he was out. He had done his time, combination of good time and time served. So maybe technically not released early, or something screwed up here, Peter.
Yeah, Jefferson Parish had a program they called Six Percenters, you know, when Harry Lee was there. What we know is 6% or 4% of offenders, juvenile offenders, commit almost all of the crime. They all know each other. They're repeat offenders, and they're very different from sporadic juvenile offenders. And the dilemma for the city right now is, what do you do with these kids? And there are a couple of bad choices. And as Woody Hayes said, they're all bad. So one, do you charge them as adults? What we know from the research, you charge them as adults and you put them in adult prison. You send them to Hunt or wherever. They're more likely to go the career. So there's a risk of creating lifelong wards of the state. The problem is, do we have sufficient juvenile care resources to leave them in the juvenile justice system? And the answer may be no. We have to beef that up. The third thing is the relationship with the adult criminals and juveniles. Often the juveniles in these kind of cases are the throwaways, you know, and there's obviously somebody running a chop shop business. Like, what do they do with the fenders or the block camp radios or whatever it is? How do they fence them? So there's an organized system here. How do we use our analytics to get a hold of what are the economics of robbing cars? You know, so there's some profound issues. And the other last issue is the shooting. The question, there's a lot of research on shootings at cars. A couple problems. One is, you don't know who's in the car. You're shooting at a window. So the question is, are you outside of the guidelines for the use of deadly force? And that's something for Sean and the investigators to work through.
So, you know, I get all that. But when you talk about juvenile care, for somebody to be arrested for armed robbery, then he pleads it down to assault, aggravated assault in grown-up court, because I guess he thinks that, or the law enforcement agency doesn't want to go to trial. They think that's the best way. You understand what I'm saying, Peter? People are hearing this saying, that's screwed up. If I go out and not as a juvenile, but it just if you're a kid, and I don't agree with this thing where the state changes the definition of a juvenile legally from 17 to 18, because at 17 legally, you are fully emancipated, right? Nobody can tell you what to do.
Right. And that's from the federal standard all over the country. At one point, you know, we were the outliers in the Raise the Age initiative, was catching up with the rest of the country. Now that's federal law. So you're a juvenile, you're a kid when you're 17. That's, you know, the law. But it's but the issue you're raising is profound. I actually agree with you. Sort of, we have this turnstile justice. The kids are, you know, booked for a day and out on the street and back to doing what they were doing. And we've got to get a response, or, we're going to get more reactive thinking and less strategic thinking about what to do with these kits. But we have a real problem. The other question I guess I have is, we've been pretty good on murders, right? Using predictive analytics to solve murders. Can we use the same technology approach to understand what are the economics of these car burglaries? How do you de-incentivize ripping off a car?
What does that look like, Peter, in terms of using analytics to lower the murder rate? What does that actually mean? What are people doing to use those analytics? And do they predict where these things are likely to happen? When?
Yeah, where does the fender go? How do you, you rob a Lexus fender, or you rob, an expensive part, or you rob the car. There's what we call a chop shop, where they chop them up and they sell the parts. Now, a lot of the parts are computer coded. So, which junkyard did they go to? Did they go to Mexico? What are the economics and what is the flow of these stolen vehicles and stolen objects in the cars? And that's where, maybe we've focused not too much on the murders, the violent crime. Paul Noel and everybody else have done a great job with that. We got to extend that analytic approach, intelligence-led approach, to solving this problem, because people are getting very agitated, as your calls and my calls are indicated.
So are you saying work on it from the demand end, and then there'll be nobody trying or no need to supply because there's no demand and somebody will do something else?
Well, you got to do several things. One is we have a non-existent intervention system with young criminals. And there are things like in Jefferson's better than we are. They have multi-systemic therapy. They have a moral recognition therapy, which you promised I'd get to talk about someday on your show. Mm-hmm. Dealing with the morality. If you think it's right to rip off a car, you're going to rip it off. You don't need a lot of psychology. You just think, hey, this guy's rich, I'm not, I'm going to take his car.
You can come back on next week and talk about that, Peter, but continue on, please.
So we don't do any of the things that the research says works with these kids. We yell at them and we harass them a little bit and send them out. They do exactly what they did last time, and we don't give them an alternative. And the other thing is, youth detention, the Youth Study Center quote, is a disaster, and the Office of Juvenile Justice is probably worse. I've worked in these kind of facilities, and we used to call it the fight culture. So you put them in there, and they get in the dorms, and they start beating the heck out of each other, and nobody gets better. They get worse, And again, that some of these facilities are schools for future crime. You meet great crime partners, but you don't get better. So we've just got to really do a serious audit of our capacity, both the Office of Juvenile Justice and the Youth Study Center and the juvenile courts, and figure out, I'm on your page, by the way, what the heck's going on here, because people are not going to put up with this much longer, and they're going to get more, reactive rather than really think it through.
So I'm 16. I'm 17 years old. I'm running with first of all, am I deciding to do this on my own, or am I running with a gang? And I don't necessarily mean, like the 3NG or whatever it is, but just a gang that, as a group, steals cars and then goes and breaks into others.
Well, I think also the adults. See, I think, we found this actually in some of the hitmen of New Orleans, that the older adults will use the young kids because they're throwaways, and they'll get out of juvenile in a short period of time. They can reuse them. So the adults, or from what my folks tell me, are engineering the economic operation.
Would this be almost, Peter, if I can jump in, because I get a question from a lot of people about this. Is it an Oliver Twist / Fagin type thing where there is one mastermind adult or a couple of them that have this band of kids that are going out and doing their dirty work?
Yeah, Charles Dickens is alive and well. I love it. Yeah, and it's probably a little more. Probably there are groups of adults that are working this, not a particular individual. And this is a system. You see, this is what you don't have a rate go up 160%, which it has, in the last 5 years, without there being a system in place. So there is an economic system, a recruitment system, a socialization system, and a selling system that's in place. And the question is, how does law enforcement, how do the courts, and how does the DA, how do you break that system down, or else this is going to go on? And then you've asked me a few times, what's the kind of chronic, property crime modes moving on to even more serious dope or violent crime stuff? And that's something that everybody's worried about. You know, and again, the bad January, we've talked about this for a few months. It's sort of been building, and sort of, is this a precursor, a negative back to the future precursor of things to come? And that's really scary. Could we go backwards?
So if we're drawing up, I'm sorry, go ahead, Peter.
No, you asked a great question.
If we're drawing up a profile, I don't think, it denotes a negative connotation, but you got to have a profile of something before you know how to fix it, right? That's accurate. That is not pejorative, is it, to say profile? To drop a profile?
What you don't understand. Exactly. Totally agree.
So we're drawing up a profile, and I think a lot of people would think that when it comes to these car burglaries, it's just a couple of kids goofing around, breaking in to see what they can steal out of the car. But what you're telling me is this is far more organized than that.
Probably. And these kids, again, the 2%ers, the 6%ers, whatever you want to call them, that most kids get in and out of juvenile crime. The problem is they're kids who don't. What do you do about it? What's your next level of intervention? So in public health, we have primary prevention, inoculations, warnings, those kinds of things. And you have secondary prevention, kids who are extreme risk. And how do you get these kids at secondary prevention to keep them from moving to tertiary prevention, which is what's called LWOP, Life Without Possible Withdrawal, in one of our fine adult prisons? That's a cost hog, and it's a human waste hog. So, how do you intervene at this level with these risk kids so they don't become lifelong criminals? That's the challenge for everybody.
Let me talk to you about the process before we run out of time here, because these two were arraigned in juvenile court, I think, and I think it's a pretty low bond of $5,000 and $10,000, because that means with $5,000, you get out if you post $500, right? And with the $10,000, you get out if you post $1,000.
Right.
But then what happened? They're being held now, and then they go to be arraigned in adult court? What's going on there?
Well, there's a process in Louisiana and most other states where you leave them in juvenile system or you waive them to adult status, right? And and when they're adult status, they're tried as adults. Some of the offenses, the aggravated assault with a car that led to the shooting, allegedly, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. That's a felony. The burglaries were considered misdemeanors, so those were tried in juvenile. So it's kind of a split verdict, and that's the nature of it. And the question is the answer to wave more kids into adult authority, one, they're going to get, but they're going to be abused in adult prison, the 17-year-olds. And then they're going to get socialized by hardened criminals. So it's maybe not a great solution to this problem to wave more kids into adult authority.
But at some point, you have to have them fear punishment, right? Because otherwise, if there's no accountability, well, hell, I'd go start breaking into cars. If I probably wouldn't. But you understand the point I'm making. If there's no fear of punishment, it seems to me this is going to continue to get worse and worse and worse.
Well, and this goes back to deterrence theory. You're asking great questions. Beccaria had a formula. Deterrence is a function of time, certainty, and proximity. The problem with draconian punishments is they often don't get implemented or take a long time. An execution takes 20 years or whatever. So that's actually not an effective deterrent. The key is that you have sufficient monitoring of juveniles and some form of controls and sanctions that are credible and certain. So that's a better option than very stiff, draconian punishment.
Very quickly, Peter. No, go ahead.
It goes back to sort of what will really keep us safer. And in my view, it's you got to get a hold of these kids. And again, you know, what are they asking at these hearings? Are they doing an assessment? Do they know what their gang affiliations are? Do they do the psychometrics? Do they know what their moral reasoning level is? Do they know what the level of impulse control is? Do they know if they have a job even? So when at those hearings, the other elephant in the room, I think in your comment is, okay, $10,000 bond, $1,000, who paid that, right? Did that come out of the chop shop or some adults bailing them out? And I've seen that many times.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. I know you'll come back next week. We'll talk about the role of the parents in this and other things because it's not going to go away. 9:53 coming back. We got a code word for you and the $1,000 nationwide cash contest. And as if that's not enough, Newell Norman's going to tell us what he has on the way for you here on WWL.